So, welcome everyone for the afternoon session, and we should start because there is a slight delay already. Our first speaker is Gustav Nilsson from the Albert Einstein Institute, and he's talking about the topology of gravitational instantons with symmetry. So,
yes,
yeah. Gustav, to start. Yeah.
Yes, can you hear me well? Okay, good. So let's start. As he said, I'm going to talk about the topology of so-called gravitational instantons possessing some kind of symmetry. So to start with, what do I mean by gravitational instanton? Well, for me, a gravitational instanton is just a Riemannian Ricci flat four manifold. So it has Riemannian signature. It's got a positive definite metric tensor. I look at a non-compact case, although it's not too bad still. It's non-compact, but it's complete, and I assume some kind of curvature decay near infinity. So it's non-compact, but it's not too bad near infinity. Assuming this, there are some different possibilities for, well, depending on how the volume grows. It can grow at most in a quartic fashion to the power of 4. And that case is called ALE, asymptotically locally Euclidean. We also have the case of AF and ALF. Both of those mean cubic volume growth. And then we actually have some inductively named cases. So these abbreviations do not really mean anything. They're just named alphabetically, and they are for quadratic and linear volume growth, respectively. So some known examples of gravitational instantons, a subset of the known examples, is the Taubnat instanton, well, the Riemannian Taubnat instanton, to be more precise. It's ALF. And then we also have the more the closely related instanton Taubbolt. It's also ALF. And we also have Eguchi-Hanson. That's got quartic volume growth. So it's ALE. And then we actually have the Riemannian Kerr. So you know the Kerr space-time. But you flip a sign in the metric, so it becomes positive definite. That's actually asymptotically flat in this Riemannian sense. And then we have the much more recently discovered Chen-Teo instanton. This is also asymptotically flat, but this is much more recent than Kerr. Okay, so for a little bit of background, I mean, it was long believed that the only AF gravitational instanton, aside from this trivial example, three space times a circle, the only other example was thought to be some example from the Kerr family. So this is basically the black hole uniqueness conjecture in Riemannian signature. So, but this was actually proven wrong by the Chen-Teo instanton in 2011 when it was discovered, because it's a counterexample. It's an AF gravitational instanton, which is not isometric to one of those. However, we can assume some additional conditions. So if we assume that we have the same topology as Riemannian Kerr, and that we have an S1 symmetry, which has only fixed points, so a circle's worth of isometries, and these have only isolated fixed points, then we have uniqueness of Riemannian Kerr, as was proven already in 1995 by Simon. Okay, and much more recently, very recently, the Chen-Teo instanton was shown to be to have a Hermitian metric, to be a Hermitian manifold by Achsteiner and Anderson, and such instantons, that is Hermitian AF or ALF instantons, which possess a torus worth of isometries, those were classified very recently too by Picard and Gaudichon. Okay, so I talk a lot about symmetries here, So all of the known AF, ALF, and ALE examples actually turn out to have plenty of symmetries. I mean, we can have an S1 symmetry. What this is really that we have a killing field whose flow is periodic. But we can have an even stronger form of symmetry, toric symmetry, where we have two independent, in a sense, circle symmetries, two commuting killing fields which each generate a periodic flow. So we'll be looking at those two cases in this talk, and for simplicity, let's restrict attention to AF and ALF, just for now, so cubic volume growth. So we start with looking at the case of toric symmetry. So as I said, we have two commuting killing fields, and this associates an invariant to the manifold, which is a kind of combinatorial invariant. It's just a finite sequence of vectors whose entries are integers, so pairs of integers. And if we have such a vector vi, then what it signifies roughly is that this linear combination vanishes along some two surface in the manifold. This two surface turns out to have to be a two sphere, actually. Okay, so the interesting thing about this is that the road structure of a toric manifold in general, given some simplifying assumptions, such as we assume that M is simply connected, and some slightly technical assumptions about this torus action, then it actually uniquely determines the topology of the manifold. So why is this interesting? Well, let us look at an example. So if we have a rod structure with three so-called turning points, what that means is really that we have one more vector, so we have four vectors. So, I mean, reparametrizing slightly, if we reparametrize the torus action, we can make sure that the first two vectors are like just like this in the picture. Okay, so then we just have two integer constants. And a priori, this could be any pair of integers, if we're not assuming anything about the geometry of the manifold. But here's where the Ricci flatness comes into the picture. So if we assume Ricci flatness, this says something about the topology of the manifold. We can use index theorems to say something about the signature and the Euler characteristic of M from the Ricci flatness assumption. And as I said in the previous slide, the topology is determined by the rod structure. So we can express the Euler characteristic and the signature purely in terms of the rod structure, so in terms of A and B purely. And thus, this Ricci flatness gives us conditions on the values of the integers A and B. In this specific case, we can actually rule out most of the values. So this is, of course, only a finite subset of the plane, but it turns out... So as you can see here, we have these black dots. These are the only ones left, not ruled out. And it actually continues in a very simple sense outside this picture, in the sense that it's just the axes that are marked outside of this and nothing else. Okay, so this is certainly interesting. And in this picture, you see the pink dots. That corresponds to the Chan-Theo instanton. There are two possible values, but that's just due to an ambiguity in the way you're parameterizing the torus action. Even though you have these first two vectors like this, there's still a sign ambiguity present. Okay, so that was an example of index theorems applied to toric.
Sorry.
Yes?
I can't see the pink from the
Hello? Yes, I cannot see the pink on your picture. Can you highlight which ones are the pink ones?
Yes. the one near the middle. So it's A is equal.
How many of them are there? It's one or it's more?
There are two. There are A is,
oh, two. Okay.
A is equal to minus and plus or minus.
If you don't count the axes, there is a finite number. That's the point of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks.
That's the point. Okay, so that was for toric symmetry. Now let's demonstrate some things about when we just have a circle symmetry. So a circle symmetry means that we have a Killing field with periodic flow. And this Killing field has a vanishing locus, the points where it vanish, and that's exactly the fixed point set of this circle action. So if you look at a connected component of this fixed point set, it's actually quite easy to show that it's either a single isolated point or it's embedded two submanifold. So this is called nuts and bolts, respectively. Nuts, that's named after the Taube nut instanton because it has a nut. I'm not sure about where the bolts terminology comes from. Okay, so in this case, recall, I assume that we have AF or ALF, cubic volume growth. In this case, it turns out that if you look at a hypersurface near infinity, that's a circle vibration over a two-surface, actually, either the two-sphere or the real projective plane. So for simplicity, in this talk, we restrict attention to the two-sphere. Okay? So circle bundles over the two-sphere are actually classified by their Euler number, which is an integer. Let's call it E. And then we can use the G-signature theorem, expressed in terms of characteristic classes and so on, but in this case, it boils down to this equality that we have here. So, I mean, this epsilon pi and wi plus minus, that's invariance of the action, how it looks locally. And this bi times bi, that's the self-intersection of the bolt. And this is an equality of rational functions. So notice that the left-hand side here is a constant, but the right-hand side is a priori not. So this tells us a lot about what values of epsilon pi and wi plus minus and so on that we must have. And it also tells us something about, you know, the signature of the manifold, of course, because that's the left-hand side. So let's look at the special case now, when we have the AF case. When E is equal to zero, then we assume that M has exactly one nut. We don't assume anything about the number of bolts. Then this signature theorem turns out to imply that, you know, the so-called total self-intersection number is equal to the signature of the manifold, which is equal to plus or minus one. So in particular, it's non-zero. So the number of terms in this sum has to be non-zero. So this means that we have to have at least a bolt. Okay, and the case with ALF, same assumption, one nut, any number of bolts. Then this vibration has non-zero Euler number. That's the definition of AF versus ALF versus AF. So in this case, we get a similar conclusion that the total self-intersection number is equal to this Euler number plus or minus one. So if the Euler number is not equal to plus or minus one, then we have the same situation as before, right? We certainly have to have at least one bolt. But the case with no bolts cannot also occur with E is equal to minus one. The Taube nut instanton, namely, it's ALF with E equal to minus one. It has no bolts and it has one nut. Okay, so I showed you an example of what we can get from these theorems in the circle symmetry case. So some concluding remarks here are, I mean, these methods are topological in nature. The Hitchin-Thorpe inequality, which I used in the first example, it uses the Ricci flattens, but it produces only a topological result still. So one might wonder, why is this important in the classification of instantons? Well, it can be a very important step in the process of proving uniqueness theorems. To prove uniqueness involving the metric, you certainly want to, it can be good to know the topology, for sure. So that's why these methods can be interesting for classifying instantons. Okay, I thank you for your attention.
Is there any question from the audience or from Zoom? Okay.
Yes.
Matthew.
So if you prove uniqueness or some result like that for the Riemannian case, does that imply anything for the Lorentzian case? Or is it like a starting point? Does it help you with anything?
I don't think it shows any kind of uniqueness for a Lorentzian case.
No.
It's more that we're interested in instantons in themselves. Yes.
Yeah, Piotr, at the back.
So your starting point for the last theorem was assuming one isometry, right? So that there exists one, at least one isometry.
Yes, circle symmetry.
Okay.
Yes.
So now when you do the Lorentzian case, when you have one isometry, you get a second one if the metric is analytic. And that's the main open problem now, right? So just to in the black hole uniqueness theorem, that this analyticity business. But now in your context, the metrics are analytic because it's Euclidean. So this part of the problem is not there. But so what would be missing is to have some kind of Hawking theorem, right? That if you have one isometry, you must have another one. Have you tried to? And this should be a local argument using either the existence of a knot or existence of a bolt or something in this spirit. Have you tried to go in this direction?
So you're saying that given that we have one killing field, that we can get another killing field?
Right, that would be the theorem here, right? If you have one, you get another, and if you have two, then you, if you're in four dimensions, you should get some kind of exploit analyticity and things like that.
Yes, that would certainly be good. Yeah, so I didn't catch what...
So maybe that's something trying to look at, right? Very bad. That's better now.
Wait a little bit, Lars. Okay. Wait a little bit. Something is wrong with the sound in the audience.
Okay,
it's better. Now, start.
Can't hear anything.
No, unfortunately, when you are talking slow, then it's coming through, but... Yeah. Now it's better, yeah.
Go. Lars, can you write maybe your question, your comment in the chat?
Yeah. Ferry, could you put it out here and I can read? So the question of Lars was... So it's different. The conjecture is that if you have one killing vector field, then you have either S1 or, if not, closed orbits, then T2 action. This was the remark by Lars Anderson.
Yes, that's true. That's what the thing with closed orbits, that's something that Gibbons and Hawking wrote in their paper, I think from the 70s or something. Yes. Yeah, I think it was just a remark.
It was it was a helping remark by Lars. It was not a question. He wanted to make it sure that either we have S1 orbits, closed orbits, or T2 symmetry in this setup. Yeah, there is another.
Just a comment on the historic perspective. I mean, the Euclidean instantons were for the Euclidean path integral to be saddle points. And so in principle, to have the Ricci vacuum, you also would have to have finite action. But since the Einstein action simply is zero, the only contribution in the asymptotically flat case can come from the boundary term. And so this was to classify these things, I mean, I guess, for quantum gravity in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's time to say thanks to Nelson if there is no any other urgent question, and let's move on. Thanks.